With great power comes great responsibility.
Compromise where you can. Where you can't, don't. Even if everyone is telling you that something wrong is something right, even if the whole world is telling you to move, it is your duty to plant yourself like a tree, look them in the eye and say no, you move.
Never step onto the battlefield of ideas unprepared. Before you enter the fray, you need a plan. And there's no better place to get one than right here on Tactics with host Caleb Colquitt. The Situation Room goes live now on News Radio 1440.
And welcome in, everybody. Happy Friday. We have made it through the first week of broadcast, which I know that you're all thrilled about. I am back on the air, hopefully doing better than ever, and really excited to complete my first week back on the air with you. It is Friday, so the weekend is upon us. We're going to have a little bit of fun, maybe a little more than we normally do, but there are still quite a few serious issues. I have to tell you, this thing is going to be a jumbled mess. Through no fault of my own, the news has just been pouring out, and let's be honest, this is not something that's uncommon. I just really didn't think about it when I went on doing a 5 o'clock show. Everybody wants news to break, basically right as everybody's leaving work on Friday. And the reason that they want news to break is because when that happens, most of the people have kind of ignored it all weekend and forgotten about it, and it seems like it has less of an impact. And so that's the reason that a lot of politicians will wait until the absolute last second on Friday, I mean like right before 5 o'clock, and then they'll release something, and it's left up to the people that have shows on the weekend or really late on a Friday, like myself, to sort of sort through and parse through all of this. So, what am I talking about here? Well, huge national news. We're going to get to some local news here in just a second, but this is really big, earth-shattering news about essentially nothing. That's right, this news program has essentially just become Seinfeld. It's the show about nothing. And the reason for that is that the Mueller investigation that has been going on seemingly since the beginning of time, you'll remember that the special counsel was appointed by Rod Rosenstein. That all took place because of the alleged collusion, and that was the original purpose of the investigation in the first place, is because there was alleged collusion going on between Trump's campaign and the Russian investigation and with the firing of James Comey, and largely because Donald Trump refused to shut up about anything. He kept talking about how essentially his motivation for firing James Comey was because of the investigation and looking into Russian collusion, and at that point a special counsel was appointed, and that special counsel was Mueller. And now Mueller has turned in his report. The investigation has officially concluded. Now, of course, that doesn't mean this is the last that we've heard about it, because there's no doubt that we're going to be talking about this for at minimum another week, which is like, I don't know, about a decade in Trump time, it seems like, with the way news cycles run now. But so this thing has come out, and there's very little news so far. Essentially, all we know is that Mueller has turned in his report to the Attorney General. Right now, that's about the extent of our knowledge. So it's something that I think was important enough to put at the beginning of my show, even though I hadn't prepared for it. But the truth is, any information that I could give you at this point would be mostly speculation. And that's the reason I'm not going to spend a ton of amount of time on it, even though I think that it's really important. Because right now, essentially anything that I could tell you would be a guess. Now, I am going to give you a couple of educated guesses, but even so, this could be completely invalidated in the next 5 minutes. I mean, that's just how breaking this story is. So, the only information that we know for sure is that there are no new indictments. So, you remember the indictments that came across people like Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, with his former National Security Advisor, General Michael Flynn. There are several people and several players that have been indicted under the Mueller investigation, but we do know for a fact, right now, the newest reports are saying there are no new indictments. So everybody that's been indicted has already been indicted, and that is actually really bad news for the Democrats, because it doesn't mean that there's absolutely nothing to this particular report, but it means there is a very high likelihood there is nothing to this report, and here's the reason and the rationale behind that. Thus far, the biggest bits of information and the hints that we've had at what Mueller might be doing has been indictments. Like I just mentioned, the indictments against Michael Flynn, the indictments against Roger Stone, the indictments against, I don't know why I just blanked on him, I just said his name, Paul Manafort. The indictments against these individuals were the biggest clue into how the investigation was going. And several people were indicted, not just the people that I mentioned, several more. And there is absolutely no doubt, and you didn't need an investigation to tell you this. I said this back during the campaign before the guy was ever president. Trump has a bad habit of surrounding himself with incredibly shady figures. It's just part of who he is for whatever reason. It's a bad habit. It gets him in trouble a lot. But here's the thing. Those shady characters seem to be the bulk of the Mueller investigation. And because of that, and because their indictments so far have all come up to be completely unconnected to Russian collusion, there's a pretty good chance that there's not a whole lot of earth-shattering news in this thing. In fact, if I had to guess, and again, this is speculation, I don't know, this story literally just broke, so I'm reacting to it as I'm just getting a very tiny amount of information trickling in. If I had to guess right now, this thing is going to be mostly a nothing burger. It's probably going to talk about some of the findings with Russia trying to break into the election, which, by the way, we already knew. We confirmed that Russia was trying to influence our election. But as far as them cooperating with Trump or even trying to steer the election in Trump's direction, because here's the thing. A lot of people have been claiming, even though there's currently no evidence of this, maybe the Mueller report changes that, I don't know, that the Russians were trying to steer the election in the direction of Donald Trump. Well, based on the hard evidence of them trying to get involved, right now the only thing we know for a fact that the Russians actually did was try to remove names from the voting roster, which wouldn't presumably help one candidate or the other, because there's no way to know which way the people that they were removing would vote. So it would definitely affect the election, but nobody knows how it would have affected the election in one way or another. And so that's really what we come across here, is that with what we know so far, there doesn't seem to be any evidence whatsoever that Russians and the Trump campaign itself actually worked together and coordinated to try to win the election. And unless that bar is cleared, unless somebody can prove there was a communication, some kind of quid pro quo, or the coordination of different people within the Trump campaign and the Russians, and then action taking place to try to steer the election in one particular direction, and in this particular direction, the direction to favor Trump, there's really nothing to this investigation. We might have some interesting findings, but the idea that this is going to be the silver bullet that finally gets Trump, there's very little reason to believe that at this point. And so we'll wait and see. We'll look at what's going on and whether or not this actually does mean something, or that there's going to be some kind of meaningful change. But it just doesn't seem that way. Now, Democrats have been laying the groundwork for a couple of weeks now, and it seems as though they're kind of trying to lay the groundwork right now to basically set up the point. They're already shifting the narrative that, well, this investigation never really mattered anyway. That's essentially what it's going to boil down to. They've essentially already set up that the... Well, actually, I should preface it by saying this. There are kind of two camps on this. Nancy Pelosi has, in the past week, set it up to where this investigation is not going to be an impeachable, or it's not going to have the results that they need to justify an impeachment. That's the best way to say it. And so what she has been saying, and the way that she has been preparing the troops for this day coming, is essentially tamping down expectations and saying, look, Trump's not worth it. Because she doesn't want to look weak, and she doesn't want to look like she's not determined to get Trump out of the White House. But she also does not want to give a false impression of getting everybody's hopes up and then saying, once the Mueller investigation comes out, we're going to get him. And then realize the investigation has nothing really in it. And then Nancy Pelosi is stuck looking really stupid because she promised her base, oh, we're going to get him based on this investigation. And if she promises that and doesn't deliver, and on top of that, doesn't use what's in the investigation specifically to try to go after him, it makes people within her base think maybe she's really not all that committed to getting rid of Trump. And she knows that, and because of that, she's sort of preparing the Democrat base, preparing members of the DNC. We're probably not going to be able to use this as the basis for an impeachment proceeding. And since they right now don't really have anything else to use as a basis for an impeachment proceeding, Nancy Pelosi has to craft a message in such a way that she looks like she is absolutely committed to getting rid of Trump at all costs, but also not going to move forward on impeachment right this second. And that was pretty much the only way that she could justify it, is try to say, well, he's not worth it. That's the way that she could do this without looking foolish, I guess, is the best way to describe it. So that's really where the Democrats stand right now. And then there's the other camp of people that are setting up a separate narrative within the Democrat Party, the Democrat faithful, that are essentially trying to retroactively pretend as though the Mueller investigation never mattered. So what you're hearing them say are essentially like, no, this was never going to be a big deal. And they even put out a request, which, by the way, I don't entirely disagree with. It, you know, on its surface, I'm on board with, I think, everything in this statement. But essentially, the summary of it was the attorney general needs to really work on getting out a ready for public consumption version of this report as soon as humanly possible, which, by the way, I actually agree with. And they're saying that transparency is the goal here. I agree with that, too. And I think that that's a good thing. I think that we should know, especially as a news junkie and as a news person, the way that I am, I really want to get as much information as humanly possible out of this thing. But here's the thing. The reason that they're setting it up and the reason they're wording this report in this way, this request in this way, is they are trying to set up a narrative that, well, the report's corrupt, because they're pretty sure there's going to be nothing in it. And if the released version of it comes out, essentially what they're going to say is, oh, well, this is Trump's newly elected attorney general. He specifically put this guy in office so that when the investigation came out, the attorney general was going to cover for him. And even though I don't really see any reason to believe that at this time, that's going to be the way that they present it. It's really not any different than what happened. I say there's not any different. The public's reaction to it is going to be similar to the way they reacted to the findings with Bill Clinton. You remember with Bill Clinton and the Monica Lewinsky scandal? You had Republicans and Democrats fighting against themselves. Oh, he had sex with her in the Oval Office. No, he didn't. Yes, he did. No, he didn't. Yes, he did. No, he didn't. Yes, he did. Then we found out, of course, yeah, he absolutely did. And then the discussion became, doesn't matter. Yes, it does. No, it doesn't. Yes, it does. No, it doesn't. Yes, it does. We're going to see exactly the same dog and pony show right now. We've been fighting for like, what, a year and a half now over the Mueller report? The whole fight has been, Mueller's a terrible human being and he's crooked and he's just out there to get Trump. Yes, he is. No, he isn't. Yes, he is. No, he isn't. Yes, he is. No, he isn't. If this report comes out and it shows that there's nothing in there, that Mueller essentially came up with nothing as far as Russian collusion, we're going to have the same kind of shift that we had in the Bill Clinton Monica Lewinsky debate. Oh, well, the findings show that there was no collusion between him and Russia. And the Democrat stance is going to be, well, that doesn't matter because the whole thing's corrupt. There really is collusion. They're just hiding it somehow. The attorney general is hiding or something. And then the Republican stance is going to be, cleared of all charges. No collusion. And so we're going to wind up having exactly the same fight. So despite the fact that new evidence, new information is going to come out, unfortunately, the pointless bickering is probably going to continue going on. And that's a little bit depressing, but that's probably the way that it goes. So speaking of that, and speaking of the president himself, there is actually a tie-in and breaking news that just happened. I didn't have a chance to read the entire report because of how new this story is, but there was a statement made by our own Senator Doug Jones, good old Abortion Jones, up there in Washington, completely misrepresenting the people of the state of Alabama. But he won the election fair and square. That's how it goes. Won't get into all that again. Doug Jones actually said today that, well, he considers himself a radical moderate. So I don't know why Doug Jones is still trying to convince people that he's a middle-of-the-road Democrat, because he never has been, and he definitely doesn't vote like that. I mean, he votes with Chuck Schumer pretty much any time that Chuck Schumer wants him to. I will give him credit on there was one vote recently that Doug Jones actually did wind up siding with the Republicans on against most of the Democrats. And you'll remember, it was the bill that if a baby is actually born and a botched abortion took place, so they tried to kill the baby and couldn't, and somehow the baby survived the abortion, that baby now has to be protected just like any other human being. So let's give credit where credit is due. Doug Jones did vote in favor with that. However, let's also put that into perspective. Taking the stance that a child that was already born, that is out of the womb, basically, this isn't even abortion at this point, it's just straight up infanticide. Not supporting infanticide is a very low bar to clear. And even though I'm glad Doug Jones voted with the Republicans, even though the bill wound up falling anyway, even though I'm glad Doug Jones voted with the Republicans on this, let's be honest, let's not pretend like it's some great achievement. He's not for killing children after they're born. Woo. Good job there, Doug Jones. Anyway, want to give him credit? Let's not give him too much credit. But today in an interview, he referred to himself as a radical moderate, which nothing in his voting record suggests that. If we're talking about abortion, you may remember he voted against a bill that would protect children in the third trimester after 25 weeks. He says, 25-week-year-old baby there in the womb, yeah, you should be able to kill that. That was Doug Jones' vote. So remember that, take that with a grain of salt when he refers to himself as a moderate. And here's another thing that is a little odd. In this same venue, Doug Jones also says that he will be voting against Donald Trump no matter who the Democrat candidate is. Which is really weird, because you would think somebody that's a moderate would at least wait until the other person comes out and sees who the Democrat is before pledging his vote to that person. Because let's look at the Democrat field right now. And by the way, this is by no means set in stone. Joe Biden hasn't even declared yet. But let's look at the Democrat Party right now. Let's look at their primary candidates that have already announced. Every single one of them has vocally praised the Green New Deal, which means they are in favor of a plan that would cost $92 trillion. To put that into perspective, if you take every cent of every currency and put it together, the total estimated value of that in U.S. dollars is somewhere around 70 to 75 trillion. Doug Jones is saying out of a field, all of which support this plan, a plan to spend more money than literally exists in the entire world, he would vote for any of those people over President Trump. But somehow we're supposed to believe that he's the moderate. And remember, this same Green New Deal also calls for getting rid of every single building in the country and rebuilding it in an eco-friendly way, getting rid of all the cattle raised for beef and dairy in the country because they emit too much CO2, getting rid of all cars and all fossil fuel-based transportation, period. But Doug Jones is a moderate. Okay. And if you'll buy that, I'm sure he has a bridge he can sell you somewhere out in California. So, Doug Jones, again, I don't know why he's even trying to pretend, trying to erect this veil, this facade of being some kind of moderate, because he's clearly not. Anybody that has spent more than 10 seconds looking at his voting record or the things that he said can tell very quickly he's nowhere even in the same ballpark as a moderate. But for some reason, he feels as though he has to put up this facade, I guess because he thinks it'll help him get reelected. I don't see why he believes that, but apparently he does. And this is how Doug Jones allegedly is planning to get reelected, I guess. But again, I just don't think that he has any chance of that. Of course, I never thought he could get elected in the first place, so what do I know? But the idea that he is going to trick the people of Alabama into thinking that he's some kind of moderate, middle-of-the-road yellow dog, that he's some kind of Democrat in that mold, I just don't think that he's going to be able to pull it off, especially not when he's voting with Chuck Schumer basically every time a vote comes up. So that being said, there are a few other local stories that I wanted to get to today. This was a weird day in the Alabama Senate for a number of reasons. But the main one, and this one is a little odd to me, a bill has passed unanimously, 26-0, so Democrats, Republicans, all on board with it. It's unanimous. You would think that something that is unanimous like this would be something that everybody could agree with. And yet, I'm oddly torn on it, and the reason is this bill has to do with marriage licenses. Now, you know that this fight has been going on for a while in the state of Alabama, ever since the Obergefell case came, and there were people, including the senator that brought up the bill this time, Senator Greg Allbritton, he's been trying to pass different versions of the same bill that do kind of the same thing. And maybe this time he's actually found the magical formula to get through this bill to end marriage licenses in the state of Alabama. But does it really? And this is what's so strange about the way that this bill works. As I understand it, the last time this bill went through, it passed in the Senate, but not the House. It got wound up getting struck down by the House here in the state of Alabama. But the odd thing is, it kind of just changes a term that we use and one requirement for a marriage license. Now, I have a little experience in this. I wouldn't consider myself an expert, but being a minister who has performed marriage ceremonies before, I've signed quite a few marriage licenses. And essentially, the way that it works in the state of Alabama is you have to have a few documents, and you have to have the bride and the groom, of course, sign it and consent to it. There needs to be a witness, and you also have to have the minister that is officiating the ceremony to sign it as well. That's why I said I've signed quite a few marriage licenses. But there's another signature that is also required, and that is a probate judge. So there's been some confusion as to how this is supposed to be executed, because you'll remember there was quite a bit of outcry in the country, especially with the judge there, or I guess she would have been a clerk, in the state of Kentucky, who was essentially thrown in jail. Not essentially thrown in jail, she straight up was thrown in jail for refusing to sign a marriage license for a gay couple. In her county in Kentucky, signing marriage licenses is part of what she does, and she took this job long before Obergefell came down. But when that happened, then all of a sudden she was thrown in jail for not doing her job. I don't even understand how they had a law in the books that they could throw her in jail, but I'm not going to relive that story again. The people in Alabama have been kind of at a loss as to how to handle this. And the reason is, to comply with the Obergefell case, you have to be able to get a marriage license regardless of where you live. However, there are probate judges in the state of Alabama that have essentially said, doesn't matter, I'm not going to do it. That would essentially be me asserting that these two men or two women or whatever are married when clearly they are not married. I don't believe that a marriage can even exist between two men and two women. Ergo, I will not sign that piece of paper. It's a violation of my religious liberty. And in that case, that provided some legal cover for these judges that do not want to be a party of participating in something that they view as sinful and is sinful according to the Word of God, that a marriage cannot exist between two men or two women. Can't be done. And so because of that, there has been a little bit of confusion. And remember, this was part of the whole Roy Moore thing that wound up getting him ousted from the Chief Justice spot, because he sent out essentially an executive memo saying that probate judges don't have to sign the licenses if they don't want to. And that's an oversimplification of that story, but I don't have time to go into it all right now. So we've been weirdly in a holding pattern trying to sort this out. And this case, essentially, what it would do is, all it would do is remove the requirement for the probate judge to have to sign off on it. So in other words, that signature is no longer required to legally observe or legally define a marriage. And oddly enough, they will no longer be called marriage licenses. They will be called forms. That seems to be the only change, the only difference that I'm seeing in this one. So basically the Senate solution to all of this jumbled mess is, well, we just won't call them marriage licenses anymore. We'll just call them forms. And we won't require judges to sign them anymore. Well, then you're just legally observing gay marriage. To me, it probably does comport with the Obergefell decision. It'll probably keep us out of legal trouble, so there is that. But it's still the state of Alabama basically giving its blessing to gay couples and saying that, yes, they are married. It is legally recognizing that. And I realize now that that's kind of a requirement because of Obergefell. I'm just saying that's what it is. You don't have the state of Alabama no longer recognizing it. It's still recognizing it. It's still complying with Obergefell. It's just doing it by changing the word that we use to call the piece of paper that you signed to say that you're married and removing the requirement of a probate judge signing off on it. That's all. So there's really very little change in all of this. It really doesn't do very much. And if I were in the Senate, and I know that's a terrifying thought, Senator Colquitt, there in the Alabama Senate. If I were in the Senate, I'm really not sure how I would vote on this. And part of the reason that I am torn on this is because it is technically removing a layer of government bureaucracy. I don't think changing the name, saying, well, it's not a license anymore, it's just a form, I don't think that does anything. I don't know why that's even in there. But removing the probate judge's required signature, technically it's eliminating a very small piece of government bureaucracy, which typically I am in favor of. But I just don't think it does anything. It's a largely meaningless bill. Now, if Senator Albritton wanted to propose something that we got out of marriage entirely, that the state of Alabama no longer issues marriage licenses, period, that I'd be all in favor of. Now, there would need to be some provisions to change the way that we look at family law, how we recognize that kind of thing. And I understand that there's a little bit of, I wouldn't even say a little bit. There's a good amount of legal gymnastics that we would have to jump through, and we would have to change several other laws that are affected by the legal recognition of marriage. But the end goal for me would be to get government out of marriage entirely. Heterosexual, homosexual, doesn't matter. And my basis for that is, marriage is an institution given by God. And so because of that, I think that the state is actually violating the First Amendment, if the state could violate the First Amendment, at least the spirit behind the First Amendment, by saying, we are going to encroach upon this particular institution that is given in the Bible. I don't want them issuing marriage licenses for the same reason I don't want them issuing baptism licenses or a license to be a deacon or an elder or any of those things. A God-given institution is not something that lies within the jurisdiction of a worldly government. And so I do think there is a distinction there, and that's the reason that I want government out of marriage entirely. But with what we're seeing here, I understand that that would be a process that we'd have to take a lot of other laws into consideration. But since this is technically getting rid of a layer of bureaucracy, that leads me more in the direction of being in favor of it, even though I don't think it does very much. But at the same time, the problem that you run into is it's still Alabama getting involved in marriage, which is wrong, but we're already involved in it now. And so I'm weirdly enough very torn on this bill that sailed through the Senate and got a unanimous vote despite it needing votes from Democrats and Republicans. So it's a weird place for me to be in. I think probably the conclusion that I would come to is I would vote against it in hopes of continuing headache, in other words, the problems that arose from having to deal with all of this, would encourage the Senate to come up with a better bill and get marriage out of the marriage business entirely as a state. That would be the long-term goal. Because of that, I think if I had a gun to my head and said how I would vote for it right now, probably vote against it. And I'm kind of hoping the House gets rid of it too. Not because I think the bill in and of itself is bad, I just think the bill's largely impotent and we're going to all stand around and act like, hey, we solved the problem by basically doing nothing. And that kind of bothers me. So that's one thing that I do think that I would be somewhat hesitant to support it on. One other thing that I did want to mention, Senator Bill Hightower has announced a potential bid for District 1 in the U.S. House. So District 1 of Alabama, he wants to represent the state and District 1 of our state in the United States House. Now, why is this? Because, you see, he's the seat's current occupant, Bradley Byrne, is running for Senate, and because of that, he is not going to be running for the House, and there is no incumbent running. So essentially, what's going to happen is that Bill Hightower is going to be running, and he does already actually have an opponent, but he's going to be running where there is no incumbent. It's a weaker Senate seat. And so because of that, it looks like State Senator Hightower is going to be running for the U.S. House. And I don't know. It seems like an odd thing for me that Bradley Byrne isn't going to instead seek re-election in the House, because honestly, with Mo Brooks and Jim Ziegler, both of whom have better name recognition than Bradley Byrne, I don't think it's a wise thing for him to go for the Senate. I don't think he can win that primary. Maybe I'm wrong. Goodness knows I don't exactly have a perfect record when it comes to predicting elections. But, you know, I just don't think that he's going to win it. I don't see it. I think that Jim Ziegler has a really good shot. If I had to pick a favorite right now, I would probably say Mo Brooks. Maybe Mo Brooks' reputation was tarnished a little more by Mitch McConnell than I wanted to give it credit for, or maybe, I don't know, maybe people still think that Mo Brooks is somehow anti-Trump and that's going to play into it, so maybe Jim Ziegler pulls ahead, but either way, I don't see Bradley Byrne as being one of the top candidates right now. I would say that that race is probably between Brooks and Ziegler, but what do I know? I'm very good at predicting things and ideologically. I'm very bad at predicting how elections will turn out. So you have to go with what you're good at. But the question is, does he have a shot? I do think he has a shot. Senator Hightower came in dead last in the primary for governor. But part of the reason for that was Governor Ivey basically walked away with it. She didn't even have to do a runoff. I mean, she won in very convincing fashion. And so, yeah, Bill Hightower didn't do very well, but neither did the other two candidates. Neither did Scott Dawson or Tommy Battle. They didn't have a very strong showing either. And so because of that, I would say that probably he's got a better shot than his very low rank in the Republican primary for governor would suggest. And actually, this may be a better call for him, because you have to keep in mind, he's somebody that's very well known in the Mobile area, and granted, District 1's a lot bigger than Mobile, but that's his home turf. And unlike governor, he doesn't have to run in a statewide election. He's running in just District 1. So if I were his political advisor, I'd tell him to go for it. I think he probably does have a pretty good shot. I think that Bill Hightower, there's a very good chance that he winds up being the representative for District 1 of Alabama. So, and because he ran for governor, his name recognition is probably a lot better now. I think there are several things that are going for him in this election. Now, the question then becomes, is he the right guy for the job? Is he going to be a good representative of the state of Alabama? Well, he's conservative-ish. He was certainly more conservative than Governor Ivey. Like I said, Governor Ivey was the least conservative out of those four candidates. He's more conservative than her, and I get that's not a very high bar to clear. He is very pro-business, but he's more establishment Republican on business than he is libertarian. And what I mean by that is he kind of likes crony capitalism a little too much. That was sort of the impression that I got from him listening to his stump speech and listening to some of his appearances that he made in other places. And his voting record in the Senate kind of leans to that as well. I'm not saying that he's absolutely corrupt and he's a good old boy and, you know, he's basically the same as Mike Hubbard. But I am saying that there is at least a twinge of that. He's a lot more establishment Republican. He's a lot closer to a rhino than he is sort of my libertarian leanings would like. So I don't know that he would be the best candidate, but I don't think he's going to be a bad candidate either. But this election's a long time off. We'll just have to wait and see. And that's really the bottom line. So I tell you what, we're going to go ahead and take a break here. And when we come back, I did want to go over this really incredible piece that goes and takes a timeline and looks at Chief Justice Roberts. This book just broke. Chief Justice Roberts and how he came to the Obamacare decision. We'll do that in just a second.
And now for a reading from the Social Justice Warrior Bible with Pastor Gregory Post.
Welcome in. I'm Gregory Post, head pastor at the Eternal Living Word Transdenominational Community Church and Coffee House in Novato, California. And now it's time once again for another reading of the SJW Bible. Today's story is going to be about how Naaman was cured of his leprosy in 2 Kings chapter 5, verses 8 through 14. And it says, "It happened when Elisha, the man and or woman of God, depending on how he identified at the time, heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes, and he sent word to the king saying, 'Why have you torn your clothes? Now let him come to me, and he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel.' So Naaman came with his horse and his chariots, which were sustainably raised and emitted no greenhouse gases, and stood at the doorway of the house of Elisha. Elisha sent a messenger to him, saying, 'Go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh will be restored to you, and you will be clean.' Not that I'm implying that you were dirty just because you were a leper. That would be leper shaming. But Naaman was furious and went away, saying, 'Behold, I thought, he will surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand all over the place and cure the leper. Are not Abana and Paphra and the rivers of Damascus better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean?' So he turned and went away in rage. Then his servants came near and spoke to him, saying, 'Wow, that Elisha guy is such a xenophobic jerk. Where does he get off implying that the rivers in Israel are better than the rivers in our country? That nationalist jerk probably believes in Israeli exceptionalism, too.' So then God spoke to Naaman directly and said, 'Naaman, I am so sorry for being intolerant and not accommodating enough. I should never have asked you to have to go and do something to be cured. You believe in me, and since purification comes from faith only, I'll just go ahead and heal you right here and now.' And from that hour forward, his flesh was cured, and they all went out to try some local craft beer." Wow, so inspirational. Thank you for listening to this reading of the SJW Bible. And remember, the only truth that matters is your truth. And welcome back. Thank you so much for holding with us through the break. Now, I have a couple of stories that I want to get to, but one that I really wanted to bring up because I just found this absolutely fascinating, mainly because I know that this is going to be a big surprise to my audience, but I really like being right. It's just a thing that I like. Most of us do. But I really like being right, and weirdly enough, this story, even though it's one of those things where I kind of hate being right, this kind of proves that what I, and believe me, it's not because I'm such a super genius, a lot of conservatives had been speculating on this for a long time, that we were right about our characterization of how Justice Roberts actually came to the decision to save Obamacare. So we're going to go ahead and look at this. These are some excerpts from a new book that just came out, The Life and Turbulent Times of Chief Justice John Roberts. And this is a book by Joan Biskupic. I have no idea how to pronounce that. But anyway, it's a new book that's out, and it does shed a little bit more light than we previously had on John Roberts and how he came to the decision to salvage Obamacare. So I'm going to read through just a few parts of this and comment on it. So here's one. Roberts' moves behind the scenes were as extraordinary as his ruling. He changed course multiple times. He was part of the majority of justices who initially voted in a private conference to strike down the individual insurance mandate, the heart of the law, but also voted to uphold an expansion for Medicaid for people near the poverty line. 2 months later, Roberts had shifted on both. With final tallies 5-4 to uphold the individual mandate and 7-2 to curtail the Medicaid plan, came after weeks of negotiations and trade-offs amongst the justices. There's several parts of this that are incredibly disturbing and problematic. First of all, there's nothing wrong with a person changing their mind when they get new information. However, that is not the impression that we're getting from this particular article. The impression that is given is that Justice Roberts changed his mind several times, not because he had new information, or not because he saw the law in a different light, or saw an argument that was specifically appealing to him and thus changed his opinion on what he already thought. Based on everything in this article, and I'm hoping that, you know, if I get a chance to read the full book, that I'll have a little bit better handle on this, but based on these excerpts that I have provided by CNN, it seems as though his decision-making process essentially came down to how he was perceived and deals that he made with other justices. And that's not right. Because especially if you're looking at this last little line right here, that over the course of 2 months, Roberts had shifted back and forth on both of these stances that he held, not because he got new information, but because of what other justices were saying to him. That's not a good place to be in. Because it essentially makes it seem as though the court is no different than the legislature. See, that's something that's supposed to happen in the legislature. That there are supposed to be congressmen and senators and House members, whatever, that and also lobbyists that are, oddly enough, actually part of the thing, not in an official capacity, but you know what I'm saying. That there are concerned citizens or other people that come in and confer with them and give them new arguments and new information and change their opinions on things. And then the congressmen talk amongst themselves and build coalitions and do compromises and then come to a conclusion. It's not the way a justice is supposed to function. The way a justice is supposed to function is essentially the Supreme Court has exactly one job: to look at things and say, constitutional, not constitutional. That's it. That's not the impression that we're getting from this story about Chief Justice Roberts, that he was talking to other justices and wheeling and dealing behind the scenes and trying to get to a decision that he wanted rather than the decision that was either constitutional or not constitutional. And that is a real problem. So let's go ahead and read a little bit further on. The discussion focused on the individual insurance mandate and Congress's power to regulate commerce. Roberts went first, and as was the custom, laying out his views, he emphasized that he believed the Constitution's Commerce Clause never was intended to cover inactivity, such as the refusal to buy insurance. After the chief, conservative justices Antonin Scalia, Anthony Kennedy, and Clarence Thomas, okay, saying Anthony Kennedy is a conservative justice is a bit of a stretch, but let's continue, and Clarence Thomas offered their views, like Roberts, They thought Congress's Commerce Authority did not cover an individual's decision to forego rather than to obtain health insurance. There were thus four immediate votes cast to invalidate the mandate. No one at the table was surprised. Based on the questions during oral arguments and word from law clerks inside the building circulating intelligence amongst the justices' chambers. Okay, so essentially, what we're getting told here is that Chief Justice Roberts believed that the Commerce Clause, and this was the justification for the bill being able to mandate that you must buy this product, you must buy health insurance, that, well, the reason that we have the constitutional authority to do that is because of the Commerce Clause, which is shaky at best because typically insurance doesn't cross state lines anyway. But even if it does, it doesn't cover inaction. In other words, you can't regulate somebody saying, well, I don't want to buy it. You might be able to regulate the business to a degree if someone wants to buy something and it is affected across state lines. In other words, if you live in Georgia and you want to buy a bunch of peaches from Chilton County, you could theoretically see how that could be regulated because it is crossing state lines and it is the federal government's job to regulate interstate commerce, at least to an extent. But the idea that you could say to the guy in Georgia, no, you have to buy these peaches because it's crossing state lines. That's essentially what Justice Roberts and the other justices are saying here, is like, you can't use the Commerce Clause to justify regulating an inaction, regulating a person's decision to not do something or to not engage in a marketplace. And yet, we see this shift happen in Justice Roberts, that even though he still believes that and remains firm on it, he kind of just lets that little constitutional technicality slide so he can get the result that he wants. And this will be made clear in the next reading. No vote had been taken to congressional taxing power. It did not seem to matter, because the individual mandate was going to be struck down. The only uncertainty was whether any of Obamacare would survive. Roberts did not want the entire law to fall. A pro-business conservative, he understood the importance of the insurance industry to U.S. business, and he was genuinely concerned about invalidating an entire law that had been approved through the democratic process to solve the intractable healthcare problem. Okay, so there's two really big red flags that pop up in that last statement. First of all, Roberts didn't want to invalidate the law because it was democratically passed. That's not your concern. Your concern is it constitutional? Is it not constitutional? Whether or not the law passed democratically, which technically it didn't because it was passed by elected officials that were voted on. But, you know, let's not worry about the actual definitions here for just a moment. Because he's worried about a law that passed, and it did legitimately pass the House and the Senate and signed by the president. And I understand all that. He's saying, well, it passed that way, so I don't really want to strike down the whole thing. Why? That's not your concern. How it passed is not your concern. Your concern is, does it comply with the Constitution? Does it not comply with the Constitution? And if it doesn't, regardless of whether Congress and the president put it forward legitimately, if it doesn't mesh with the Constitution, you still got to strike it down. That's the way being a justice on the Supreme Court is supposed to work. And so that's the first major red flag. The second one is that essentially he didn't want, That was my last point. He was saying that even though he had not considered the congressional taxing power, he started looking for ways to save Obamacare is essentially the assertion that is given here. So that was previously not a question, but it became a question when Robert started looking for ways to save Obamacare. So his motivation was he didn't want to strike the whole thing down. So he changed his opinion on something, not because he found a way to make it constitutional, but instead because he didn't want the perception of his court striking it down, which makes no sense. He's operating like an elected official. He's operating as though he's somebody that's running for re-election and wants the public's approval. That's not his job. And so he's already got the wrong motivation. Now he's got the wrong methodology, that he starts searching for ways that I'm going to save it. So I've got to figure out a way to try to shove this square peg into a round hole so that I can justify saving the thing because that's the result I want. So he made a result in his head and then started looking for ways to justify it. That's not the way being a justice is supposed to work either. You're supposed to look at evidence and make a decision based on that evidence. That's the way this process is ideally supposed to work. And Roberts did it in reverse. That's not the way that you're supposed to reach a conclusion as a justice, especially a chief justice of the Supreme Court. So, let's look a little bit further down. But this, for his fellow, but his four fellow conservatives believed that if the individual mandate was going down, it should take the whole law with it. They believed that all the pieces were interlocked. Roberts thought the individual mandate was entwined with only two other provisions, known as the community rating and the guaranteed issue. The community rating section prevented insurers from changing some individuals' higher premiums than others based on status. The guarantee issue section required insurers to cover people regardless of pre-existing conditions. So here's another problem that he ran into. Justice Roberts' main motivation seemed to be, well, I don't want to strike down the entirety of it because it's connected to the individual mandate. I think that it should only be connected to this. But the other justices are saying, no, we have to gut the whole law because it's so interconnected that if we strike down the individual mandate, the rest of it is going to crumble. Which, by the way, is exactly the argument, oddly enough, that President Obama himself made about the individual mandate. Because people were saying, well, why don't you just take that provision out before it passed? And his explanation was essentially, if you take it out, then the whole thing's going to come down like a house of cards, because that's what's funding the whole thing. The requirement that you have to buy insurance, that you have to be in the pool. And of course, President Obama was actually correct on that. But the point is, Roberts is trying to figure out a way to put up some scaffolding to hold this thing up, because he wants to get rid of the individual mandate, but not the whole law, even though President Obama himself said that's exactly what is going to happen if the individual mandate is no longer a part of this. And so, finally, we'll just look at this last little piece here. Breyer and Kagan had voted in private in a March conference to uphold the new Medicaid requirement, and their votes had been unequivocal, but they were pragmatists. If there was a chance that Roberts would cast a critical vote to uphold the central plank of Obamacare, and negotiations in May were that they considered still shaky proposition, they were willing to meet him partway. When Ginsburg found out that Roberts' new position, her first thought was, it ain't over until it's over. She understood that the process could continue to be fluid, especially in such a monumental case. People changed their minds about what they thought, so it isn't all that extraordinary, and that's how it should work. We're in the process of trying to persuade each other and the public, she told in a 2012 interview in her chamber. The reason this is so bothersome to me is when you read those couple of paragraphs, this is pure, unadulterated politics. And the whole point of having a Supreme Court is to keep politics out of it. They had a branch that was specifically selected to be as apolitical as humanly possible when you're talking about an actual branch of the government, and to keep opinions and feelings and coalition building out of it. And that's the reason they are the ones that are supposed to review whether or not something is constitutional or not. Because what the other justices think about it is not supposed to play into it. And what you've got here is confirmation that behind the scenes, you had the liberal justices sort of wheeling and dealing, trying to get Roberts on their side. And you have to give them credit, it actually did work. But the way that this was handled was just so incredibly distasteful. And it just absolutely reeks of politics. And that is not something that you want in the Supreme Court. Now, even though I might not like the result, you have essentially the same thing said about Congress members. I don't say anything because it is their job to wheel and deal. It is their job to make laws and compromise and that kind of thing. It's not a justice's job to do that. And that's the reason that I have a real problem with this. So it looks like we've had a couple people that are trying to call in. So we'll go to calls right after this last little bit that I'm going to read. And this kind of summarizes the whole thing. And I want you to remember, the person that's writing this is not necessarily somebody, I don't know what their political leanings are, but based on the writing and the way that they phrase it, I don't think that they're all that conservative. So this is the last paragraph that really kind of clinches the whole thing and summarizes it. Viewed only through a judicial lens, his moves, talking about Roberts, of course, were not consistent, and his legal arguments were not entirely coherent, but he brought people and their differences and interests, different interests together. His moves may have been good for the country at the time of division and a real crisis in healthcare, even as they endangered in the years since, engendered in the years since, anger, confusion, and distrust. All right. So it seems as though the author, and maybe I'm mischaracterizing it, but it seems as though what the author is saying is, okay, yeah, from a strictly legal judicial lens, yeah, it's not consistent, and it doesn't really make any sense, and he didn't arrive at his conclusions the way that a justice really should, but, you know, it made people feel real warm and fuzzy. Who the crap cares? Show me in the Constitution, open it up, Article 3, point to me the feel-good cause. It's not a justice's job to care what people's interests are. It is not a justice's job to try to bring people together. It is not a justice's job to try to make people feel good about what happened. A justice's job at the Supreme Court level is to decide, is this constitutional? Is it not constitutional? Period. End of story. And the idea that, well, it brought people together and maybe it didn't work out so well in the end, but that's justified because people felt good. No, none of that makes any sense. That is not your job. In fact, out of all the three branches of government, that's the only one that you shouldn't care what people think about it. That's the reason that they're not elected. That's the reason that they have lifetime appointments. Because they're not supposed to care what people think about the rulings. The only thing they're supposed to do is say whether it's constitutionally acceptable or not. And if not, you gotta throw the law out. Or at least throw out parts of it. In this case, they probably would have had to throw the whole thing out, which I just laid out that case for. But the point in all of this is that you cannot just sit there and decide that because it made people feel good or because it brought people together, which of course, in the end, it really didn't, that justifies not adhering to the Constitution. And so there's just a number of reasons why this is absolutely asinine from every single conceivable angle you could look at this at. All right, so the thing is, I actually would like to go just a little bit longer here, but I'm winding down and I need to get out of here because I'm actually covering the NCAA basketball tournament over on Sports Radio 740. I'm doing the technical production, so I got to get out of here pretty quickly because my shift starts very soon. So what we're going to do is, even though I had a couple of fun things that I had planned, we're going to have to go ahead and go straight to the chaplain's report.
In 1775, the Continental Congress created the Chaplain Corps. Under the command of General George Washington, each soldier was required to attend worship service every Sunday. While other armies advanced on their feet, Washington's troops advanced on their knees. It's time for the Chaplain's Report with Caleb Colquitt on tactics.
Chaplain's report today comes from the book of Titus, and one thing that you do need to know before we go into this is just remember that Titus is a pastoral epistle, which means when Paul is writing it, he's specifically talking not to a congregation like he is in Ephesians or Colossians. He's not talking to a whole congregation. He's talking specifically to church leaders. And so because of that, he addresses them slightly differently. So let's look at Titus 3, 8 through 9, where he says, This is a trustworthy statement, and concerning these things, I want you to speak confidently, so that those who have believed in God will carefully engage in good deeds. These things are profitable for men. But avoid foolish controversies and genealogies and strife and disputes about the law, for they are unprofitable and worthless. There's a couple things that I want you to really sort of hone in on here. That Paul is giving advice for how church leaders are supposed to speak. First of all, he says, concerning these things that I've taught you, the things that I've addressed earlier in this epistle, I want you to bring this to the church. And when you do it, I want you to speak confidently. So these are kind of a little advice from Paul on good leadership practices specific to the church. That I want you to speak confidently because you know where this has come from. You know that it is the inspired word of God. And because of that, I want you to speak with a certain level of boldness and confidence, knowing that God is with you when you do that. Because he says that the reason for that is not so that they can gain glory or prestige or that other people think well of them. The real goal, the mission behind all of that, is I want the people of your congregation to thrive and to grow closer to God. Because I want them to do good deeds. And what do those good deeds do? They edify one another. Paul says that they are profitable to the people, not only the people that have good deeds done for them, but the people doing the good deeds themselves. Which means that the reason that he wants the leadership to be the best that they can be and to speak confidently and boldly and encourage and inspire the people that are there at their congregation to do these good works and to sort of spur them on and encourage them, as he said, it's going to make your congregation better. It's going to make the people around your congregation better because good deeds are being done. And essentially, that's what your job is. Because isn't that really what we as church leaders are tasked with? We are supposed to encourage the brethren around us, the ones that we're helping lead, to do good works and to live a godly life. And he's saying that part of that is to speak with confidence and boldness and declare the word of God, because if you do that and you do your job, you do what I've asked you to, then those that you have been given charge over are going to be made better people because of it, because you inspire them to do the work of God. Church leaders have an obligation to hone their skills in leadership, in speaking and bringing people and teaching them. They have an obligation to improve themselves and be the best that they can be in all of those things so that the people they are leading can also be the best that they can be. And you have to remember that if you're a church leader, God is going to help you with that. There are countless examples in the Bible of people that were not in great positions to be leaders. And after some time spent with God, they became some of the greatest leaders in all of human history. People like Abraham and Moses and Joseph and David. And because of that, they became better people and they made other people around them better by their presence because they had a trust in God and they did what God asked them to. Because these good deeds are profitable for men, which by the way also implies that there is a relationship between competent leaders and the abilities and the drive of those whom they are leading. So remember, church leaders, you do have an amazing responsibility because you're also going to be held accountable for how you prepared others. Did you prepare people to do evangelism? Did you prepare people to go out and do good works? Did you encourage them when they were struggling with things like sin or sickness? Because if you didn't, and if they... I mean, some people, even if you do the right thing, they're not going to respond to that, and that's not your fault. But if you don't do your job and they don't become what they're supposed to be and their relationship with God is injured by not having good church leadership, you're going to be held accountable to that because there is a relationship there. There's a correlation between good leadership and a good congregation. And finally, Paul recommends that leaders need to be wise and pick their battles, based on their importance. Because he's saying, these things that I've been talking about, the crux of Christianity, in other words, loving God, loving your neighbor, doing good deeds, doctrinal soundness, those things are important, and those things are worth fighting for. And then by contrast, he gives this sort of, he does give this contrast between those things and then what he calls foolish controversies, genealogies, strife, and disputes about the law. There are some things that are absolutely worth going to the mat for. But Paul is saying there's a lot of things that people fight about that it is not worth causing division in the brothers or breaking up a congregation over. And he says, even if it doesn't break up the congregation, we all know that having those disputes and having those fruitless and foolish disagreements, it hurts the brethren and it hurts their ability to do what they're supposed to do and be the kingdom of God. And so because of that, leaders also have a responsibility to pick their battles and to avoid getting into foolish controversies, controversies that really don't matter at the end of things. Now, in the heat of the moment, sometimes we can forget this. We're human beings. We can get caught up in what we're doing or what we're saying. Our desire to be right can be so strong that we forget to keep focused. But what Paul is saying here is the church leader's primary goal, their primary concern ought to be with the people that are there and that they are helping lead, edifying one another and doing good deeds. He says, if you do that and if you focus on that, then you're going to be profitable to other people and profitable to the kingdom of God. You see, church leaders have a responsibility that has everlasting consequences. And the truth is, the Lord is always in need of trustworthy workers. And when he has them, not only is everybody around them made better, but God rewards them for the good that they've done. Let's all remember that and try to continue to do profitable good works throughout our daily lives. Have a good weekend. Stay the course, friends.
Tactics is a production of News Radio 1440 and Cumulus Media Montgomery. Any opinions expressed on this program are those of the host and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Cumulus Media. The theme song for Tactics is 6 Foot Town by Big and Rich. Graphics by Jessica Dawson. Broadcast studios provided by Cumulus Media Montgomery. Location studios provided by the Dalreda Church of Christ. Copyright 2019.